G'day, I am Mordechai Becher.
And I am Yehoshua Karsh.
And welcome to Two Rabbis and a Podcast. And this week, I know we have not posted for a few weeks, and that is because both of us have been away traveling, and we're both back. And we're actually going to talk a little bit about the travels.
Yes.
I was in Croatia and Spain and Tunisia and the island of Juba.
And I was in St. Louis, Toronto, and Bayswater, New York.
Bayswater, it's a beautiful
It
neighborhood.
is beautiful.
Yeah,
Atlantic Ocean.
very nice ocean.
Yes, it is.
It's interesting. The tradition of travel is quite old. If you read, there was the Chido, Reb Chaim Yosef David Azoulay, one of the great Torah sages of the 19th century, I think he was, or 18th century, I don't remember, wrote hundreds of sfarim, books, and traveled widely, primarily to collect funds for the Jewish community in Israel. But he did a lot of tourism, and he writes about it. And Reb Binyamin of Tudela, the Jewish rabbi from Spain, medieval times, went traveling widely and went around and wrote about this. So there is something to it. I think it expands your horizons, gives you an education. And certainly if you're going to places where there's a tremendous amount of Jewish history, it is very thrilling to be there, and to see and to experience just some of the Jewish history and also some Jewish present. So shall I start with Croatia, which was
Please do.
that was
Please
the
do.
first place. So I'll tell you three places I visited: Croatia, Spain, and Tunisia. Two of them, Croatia and Spain, have basically erased the Jews. Spain, of course, Jews lived there from the time of the destruction of the Second Temple, about 2,000 years ago. They lived through the time of the Visigoths, brutally persecuted the Jews during that time. The Muslims invaded in 711. Jews lived under the Muslims for a few hundred years. The Reconquista, in which the Christians reconquered Spain, was completed by 1492. And that's when the Jews were expelled. And that decree of expulsion, done in the Alhambra Palace in Granada, was only officially rescinded in 1960 something. Although Jews were allowed as individuals to come back to Spain already in the 19th century.
Can I ask you a question? Today in our Daf Yomi, we had Aspamia. You mentioned Aspamia. Is that agreed that that is Spain? Because I've seen it translated as Spain in some places.
Yes, so it's a type of interesting question. In the Gemara, which in a few places, the Gemara in Bava Basra talks about the three lands regarding chazaka, regarding someone who squats on your land. You have to give a guide of time to get to Spain, come back from Spain, object. So that actually is understood as Spain. Aspania is Spain. The Talmud talks about also in Yevamos, and as you said, in Avodah Zarah. So there are references in the Gemara to Aspania, and that's usually understood as actually Spain.
Okay.
In Tanakh, we have, for example, in the book of Ovadia, where we are told about the Galus, the exile of Bnei Yisrael, at Tzarfat, the Galus Yerushalayim Asher Bisfarad. So Tzarfat we always translate as France, and Sfarad as Spain, and that's how the Radak, Reb David Kimchi, who lived in southern France, he actually does translate that as what we call today, he says, France and Spain. And Rashi says that as well. Rashi actually quotes the Targum Yonatan, who translates Sfarad as Aspamia, the word you mentioned from the Gemara.
Okay.
Historians doubt that that is actually what it refers to. There is a region in Turkey, called it's a region in Turkey, which is the ancient name of it was Sfarad. It just seems more likely that the exile of the Jews to Sfarad was to this place much closer, Turkey, rather than to Spain, First Temple period. It's possible, Razak and Rashi, but generally the Spain mentioned the Gemara, and Spain, was a Roman colony, Hispania, and Jews were already there for sure. There are traditions that Jews were there from the time of the Maccabean Wars, which is first, that's first and sorry, Second Temple period, but for sure. From 2nd century CE, Jews were exiles already there. First century, 2nd century from the Roman Wars, there were already Jews in Spain. As you know, erased. There are only three shuls in Spain which have still survived, synagogues that have survived from before the expulsion, two in Sevilla and one in Cordova. And in Sevilla, by the way, the one in Sevilla had graffiti on it. Free Gaza with a swastika, 12th century archaeological treasure. And see, these scum anti-Semites had, unbelievable. So now, today there are Jews in Spain. There's a community, tens of thousands. There's a Jewish day school. There's a few, two Jewish day schools. There are functioning synagogues that have everyday prayers. There are kosher restaurants, actually some pretty good ones. So there is a community there in Spain. Yeah, type of interesting. There is discussion because there's a responsum of Rabbi Eliezer Yehuda Waldenberg, the Tzitz Eliezer, who discusses, someone asked him, I heard he said that there is a cherem, a ban of excommunication on living in Spain. And if you ever heard that, there's a
No.
ban against living in Spain. And he said he searched halachic legal literature, could not find anything. So he asked his good friend, Reb Ben-Tzion Meir Chai Uziel, who was the former Sephardi chief rabbi of Israel, and he said there is, he says it's very widespread amongst the Sephardi Jews that there is a ban on, even though it's not in writing. He actually mentions that the name Toledano, it means Toledo, no.
Really?
We're not going back to Toledo. Now, I don't know if that's, but that's, and he said there appears to be such a ban, but it appears to be widely ignored, right? Certainly okay to visit, but in terms of living there's no evidence of such a ban other than an oral tradition type of, but
Were the shuls that you encountered? Were there any Ashkenazi shuls there, or were they all Sephardi shuls?
I did. There are some Chabad shuls which are
Okay, yeah, that's Ashkenazi. Yeah.
Ashkenazi,
Cool.
but the actual the indigenous, I guess, shuls are Sephardi. But the Jewish, so you go to places as we did to Barcelona. Barcelona had one of the greatest yeshivas in history, which was the yeshiva of the Rashba of Shlomo ben Aderet, student of Nachmanides and his first cousin, Rabbeinu Yonah, both from Girona. That was our first stop in Spain, was Girona, where Nachmanides was born and lived and grew up, Rabbeinu Yonah, and he was famous. There is the only remnant in Girona of anything Jewish is a house which people say was the house of the Ramban, Nachmanides. We don't really know if it was his house. There's some circumstantial evidence, but it's a house. There is a synagogue there. It's a Chabad house in Girona, that's about it. That's about it. Nothing. You can't see anything, pretty much, right? You might see, if you go into a church, you might see some Hebrew inscriptions because it was converted from a synagogue. So their student was Rav Shlomo ben Aderet, prolific. Commentary on the Talmud, prolific author of responsa, thousands of responsa, and he had a yeshiva there. No remnant, no remnant. You can go in Barcelona. There's the court where supposedly the debate took place between Nachmanides and Pablo Cristiani in the 13th century. But there's not much there. Cordova, where Maimonides was born and grew up till he was 16. His father was a judge and was a magnificent Jewish community. There's one remnant of a synagogue left where there's a Sephardic heritage museum there, which is actually an excellent museum, very small, but excellent. And the docent there performed traditional Sephardic songs and chazanut for us there.
Really?
He was a beautiful voice, great, just fantastic.
When you say traditional, did it have an Arabic flavor to it, or
I would say somewhat. In other words, what we call Andalusian music is really a combination of Spanish and Arabic and North African music. Today in Israel, there's been somewhat of a revival of Andalusian music, and there are a number of orchestras, that Andalusian orchestras that play this stuff, and it's magnificent, beautiful. I played it. I was talking to my students at Yeshiva University. I played them a clip of the Andalusian orchestra playing some Yom Kippur music songs from the, and a number of the guys in my class, Ashkenazim, said,
"Yeah,
he says, if synagogues sounded like that, I would go more often."
I have I give a class to a group of people who are all Sephardic. They're mainly like from around Turkey, Ladino kind of culture. And I remember talking to them once before Rosh Hashanah, and they were so mystified that my Rosh Hashanah experience had a somber and awe-filled tone, because their tunes were all lively and joyous and upbeat.
I went to last year for the Shabbat of Slichot, where we do these prayers of supplication and remorse and repentance before Rosh Hashanah and between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. So I went to a scholar in residence in Los Angeles at a Sephardic Iranian Persian minyan called JFK. That stands just for Kiddush. That is justified because the Kiddush was unbelievable. But in any case,
yes.
The Slichot, I had more fun at their Slichot than I have had at certain weddings of Ashkenazim. It's like, you know, their feeling is God will forgive us. He loves us. I've done mistakes. I'm a human being. You know, it's a confidence. It's beautiful. In any case, it's Andalusian music.
People say, by the way, when you visit Spain, just in general, not just to visit the Jewish sites, there is a sense that they just enjoy life a lot more than we tend to. Americans, you know, like not just Jews, but just like that there's a sense in general that they've figured out how to just be a little bit happier.
It's a beautiful country. The geography is gorgeous. It's pretty hot in the summer, but it's in general a nice climate. There's amazing agriculture there. There's beautiful landscapes. It's surrounded by the Mediterranean.
Yeah.
It is conducive, you know, to enjoyment.
Yeah.
And during the time when the Jews lived there amongst the Muslims and the Muslims controlled it, they had what's called, the word uses convivencia, living together. But Cordova, beautiful gardens and fountains, and and if you read the poetry of the great, we've discussed this, but the poetry of the great rabbis there, and they talk about it was a party culture. You know, people would get together and there'd be music and wine and poetry, and you know, it was some interesting culture. So anyway, you go to places like, so we went to Girona and Barcelona, Toledo, which is of course where Rabbeinu Asher, the Rosh, was, who escaped Germany in the 13th century and came to Spain and was a Yiddish-speaking Ashkenazi rabbi who was so brilliant that he was accepted by the population of his area in Spain as their chief rabbi, which is why a lot of customs of those that area are actually Ashkenazi. And of course, his son became the author of the the precursor to the Code of Jewish Law. I mean, ideal situation, the nexus of Ashkenaz and Sephard were there. It's pretty amazing. But again, you can't see anything. There's no remnant. There's like you could go to a courtyard of a church and see some Hebrew writing down the bottom of the, and that's about it. So it's right. You go to places like Granada. There's the Alhambra Palace, which is magnificent, magnificent palace. And of course, that's where the decree of expulsion was written. So, as beautiful as the palace is, there's a dark side to it, which is when Isabella and Ferdinand conquered that, one of the first things they did was write the decree of expulsion. And Cordoba, there's a place, Elisena, or Lucena, as they call it today, which is where there was another great yeshiva. That was a yeshiva that was the head of the yeshiva was Rabbi Yitzhak Alfasi, who had studied in Tunisia and had moved to Spain in his 70s and established a yeshiva. And in that yeshiva, two of the students, one of them was Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, one of them was Rabbi Yosef ibn Migash.
What about Rabbeinu Hanano? Wasn't he also a
Rabbeinu
Talmid?
Hananel was
Oh, back in Morocco or in
in
Tunisia.
Kairouan in Tunisia. And we'll get to Tunisia. And another student, Rabbi Yosef ibn Migash, who he had a student, Maimon, who was the father of the Rambam, Maimonides. It's like, and of course, today in Lucena, there's nothing to see. But it's a beautiful country. There's a certain, I get a pleasure and joy in walking in places where I know that the Rambam, Maimonides,
That's what
Nachmanides
I
walked.
wanted to know if you, even though, did it make a difference to you as far as that feeling? Because you've been in Europe, you've been to other places where, great rabbinic figures had been. You've been to Eretz Yisrael, where the Avos were. Did you, so in Spain, you were able to feel it?
I think I felt that. Maybe it's just I'm deluding myself, but I think I felt something in these places. I think definitely there's a some type of level of revelation that you can tap into when you're in a certain place. I don't know if you've had that experience. I remember there was a certain Maharal idea in the Maharal that I didn't really I was working trying to understand it. I did this tour in Prague, and we're at the Altnoy Shul, one of the synagogues of Prague where the Maharal frequented. And the explanation of the Maharal came to me while I was there. Like I wasn't,
Cool.
I was in the shul, his synagogue. And, it was just, I don't know, maybe there's something to that. But I did feel something special about, being able to be in the places where they lived, to see the environment that they lived, to see the buildings, because a lot of the buildings are from that time.
So you didn't need there to necessarily be lots of artifacts. There was enough there for you to feel the connection.
I felt that, yeah. Sevilla or Seville, which has two synagogues there, which date back pre-expulsion. Was actually the place where it was the central government. There was not a large Jewish community there in those times, but there was most of the Jewish community who lived in Seville pre-expulsion were people who worked for the government.
Did you get a haircut while you were there?
No, I did not.
Okay. Just wondering.
I did sing some opera, and
Okay.
the rabbi of Seville was someone we know as the Ritva, Reb Yontef ben Avram Alasvili. Al-Asvili means from Seville.
Nice.
So again, to be in the place and his name, Seville, and I've always known that, but to be in the place and see the shul where he probably prayed, that was very special as well.
Cool.
So that was Spain. Then, we started off before Spain, we were in Croatia. Croatia, I don't think I would challenge anyone to tell me that they've met a Croatian Jew or a Jew of Croatian descent. You almost never meet them. Why? Because during the Second World War, Croatia had the was the only country that created their own concentration camp without the prompting or aid of the Nazis. They did it themselves. The estimate is that something like 95% of the Jewish population was murdered. There are Jews, Croatian Jews living in Croatia, tiny, tiny community. We met some of them. But Croatia has also, people do not realize the incredible history, and there's artifacts, there's synagogues, and tremendous history. There's a place called Split. So Split, or in Hebrew, Isplatro, was a place where the Emperor Diocletian retired. He was the only Roman emperor to actually retire. He wasn't assassinated. He didn't die an emperor. He retired, and he went to Split. And he actually liked that the Gemara discusses him in a few places. And he liked the Jews and hated the Christians, because he felt the Christians wanted to take over the empire and make it Christian. He was right; they did. Right, and the Jews just wanted to live. Just there's actually a there's in his palace in Split, there are some engravings of menorahs, and there's also some dye works of the making of tchelet, the special blue that we make for the tzitzis.
What
And
year? What years was it?
Diocletian was, gosh, probably 2nd century, something like that.
So it's not so late.
No, Diocletian was
Right.
in, sorry, third, 305. He
Okay.
was in Split. And it appears that there were already Jews there, in that area, again, because it's part of the Roman Empire.
Right.
And just by the way, the dye of Tehelet, the Adriatic, which Croatia is on the Adriatic, is probably the main supplier of the Murex truncula snail. That is the source of the blue dye we use for tzitzis. We actually had a fisherman come to our hotel, and he owns a commercial fishing company. He's not like a guy with one boat, and he is one of the main suppliers of Murex truncula snails to people who produce. And he brought a bucket of these snails, and he actually cracked open the shell of one of them with a hammer, which is what the Gemara describes. And there's a yellow stuff that exudes out of that. He takes that yellow stuff and puts it in water, and then puts it into the sun, and you see it turning blue.
Oh
So
my
the
God.
sunlight, there's a chemical reaction, turns into, was it called dibromide indigo, I think is the
I'll take your
chemical
word.
name, right? And it's magnificent. It's just beautiful blue to see. And there's remnants of that in Diocletian's palace in Split. So Split also was a place where there were great rabbis, for example, Reb David Pardo, who wrote Maskil LeDavid, which was a commentary on Rashi on Chumash, Maskil David. He also wrote Responsa. There's a fantastic responsa about him that the Jews of the city in Split had rented the city for a token amount from the Sultan in order to be able to carry in the walled city, Eruv Chatzeres. And he died. The Sultan died Friday afternoon.
Oh, and that's who they had permission
So
from.
the question was, do we assume that the rent continues and they can still carry, or do they have to do new Sultan? No time to do it. He actually ruled that they have to do a new rent.
So they couldn't
They
carry.
couldn't carry that Shabbos. It's so interesting. There were other rabbis who lived there. Just to give you a list, Rabbi Eliezer Papo lived in the area, Sarajevo, who wrote the Peleioets. Rav Yehuda Lerma, Pleitat Beit Yehuda, Rav Aaron HaKohen, Rabbi Yisrael Srud was there, who was one of the great students of the Arizal, Rabbi Isaac Luria, who went to Italy. He was also in Dubrovnik. So there were these great, great rabbis, Rav Shabtai Ventura, etc. So there is an extensive Jewish history. There was a short time where Chacham Tzvi Ashkenazi was in Dubrovnik, was in the
Really?
area for a year or two, I think. There's a prayer here. There was a plague in Split, and the Jews in Padua in Italy composed a prayer praying for the Jews in Split who were suffering under the plague. There's a 3rd century synagogue in the area, and there's a lot of stuff there. But as
That's
I
old.
said,
That's old.
third century is pretty old.
Wow.
And one of the oldest functioning synagogues goes back to the 1300s, is also there in Split.
What about the Sarajevo Haggadah? I remember
Yeah, so the
there's
Sarajevo Haggadah is
notable
right
Haggadah.
nearby. That was written in Spain.
Oh.
That was written in Spain before, like probably in the 1300s. Magnificent Haggadah. It was sold somehow, found its way to Italy, and then it was sold to in and found it, and it was in the National Library in Sarajevo. It was actually a during the Second World War, the Nazis were out to find it, and they wanted to loot it. And a Muslim, by the I've got his name here, a Muslim librarian, Dervis Korkut, smuggled the Haggadah out of the library and hid it. Dervis Korkut, aside from smuggling out the Haggadah, he also gave there was a Jewish woman by the name of Miri Papo. Could be she was descended from the Pelayo, it's the same family name. So she was fighting in the partisans against the Nazis, but the partisans were more or less
Not
as
so fond of
anti-Semitic,
Jews. Yeah,
as
not.
anti. So they left her. They took away her weapons, left her in the forest alone, teenage girl. She made her way to Dervis Korkut's house. He took her in, and trained her how to act as a Muslim and pretend that she was his Muslim niece or whatever, and saved her life.
Wow.
So he saved the Haggadah and her life. Interestingly, he was persecuted after the war by the communists. They claimed he was a Nazi collaborator. Horrific stuff. During the war in Yugoslavia in the 1990s, his children. Now he, by the way, Mira Papo, survived the war, went to Israel, and testified to Yad Vashem that Korkut had saved her life, and they sent him a certificate that he was a righteous of the nations. And anyway, he has a daughter and granddaughter who are caught up in the war. The Serbians wanted to kill, right, etc. They escaped to a Jewish community, I forget where, in that area. And the Jew and the one of the things that she had salvaged from her house as she was running was the certificate from Yad Vashem. And she showed this to the Jewish community. They contacted the Israeli consulate, and she and her daughter were able to go to Israel to
Wow.
escape the war. They were
Wow.
greeted at the airport by Miri Papo's children, whose
Wow.
her
Wow.
fa her
What a
father
great
had
story.
saved, and the Haggadah. It's really quite something.
Yeah.
There's a fantastic, I know you're into literature,
Yes.
so there is a wonderful book about the Haggadah, fiction, written by an Australian author. Hold on, boy, it's an amazing, ama really fantastic book. Basically, it's a book written about goes through the it goes through different physical forensics of the Haggadah and tells a story about each person who was who contributed to the Haggadah. I'm sorry, I wish I could find her name. Oh, here it is. It's called People of the Book
Okay.
by Geraldine Brooks.
Now that's
Geraldine,
name. She
famous
is.
Australian author. She won
Yeah.
prizes.
Yeah.
What famous? She wrote in the New Yorker.
Yeah. I recognize the name.
Yeah, you would.
Yeah.
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 So
Yeah.
she wrote people. She actually converted to Judaism. Geraldine Brooks. So anyway, that's that area. Sorry,
Yeah.
unfortunately, there was there were Jews there. There was the Jasenovac, the concentration camp was there. Unlike the Nazi concentration camps, the Croatians killed each person individually usually with knives. Their agricultural knives they used, and it was the level of savagery is something incomprehensible, even by Second World War standards. It's like, in any case.
You've walked through Poland.
Yeah.
When you were walking through Croatia, I mean, people s say that when they walk in Poland, you can still sort of feel the anti-Semitism a little bit. I don't know if you had that experience in Poland, but do you feel any of that when you're walking through with a Jewish group in Croatia?
I did not feel that in Croatia. No, did not feel
Okay.
that. In Poland, I did feel it. I was, for instance, we were in Kielce, where there was a pogrom there after the Second World War in 1945. And I got off the bus with our tour group was out. I see a group of Polish people standing there. I wanted to ask them where something was, where the street was. I had a map. I walked over to them. They all turned their backs on me.
Seriously.
There were like four of them. As I approached, they all turned their backs.
Wow.
I mean, that's mild. We have a
Yeah.
friend, Rabbi Nissel,
Yeah.
whose bus I think got stoned and attacked by anti-Semites. The
And
security guard.
somebody spit on some on one of his one of the students that he was with. But he did say that I think he said it was the Secretary of State. When he found out about it, because the chief rabbi of that area had called various people, and he did come and apologize to the students,
Okay.
right? So he did get a government
Very
apology.
possible.
But the experience, I had heard that from others who have been in Poland, that you can sort of feel it. But you said in Croatia, you did
Didn't really
not.
feel
So
it. I don't know if they
somehow.
knew we were Jewish. Maybe they knew we were Jewish or not. I mean, we were always wearing, as you know,
Yeah.
universally, if you put on a baseball cap, it's impossible to know that you're Jewish.
The only people that wear baseball caps while they're traveling are Orthodox Jewish people. It's well known.
I thought this was a perfect disguise, but okay. And my cap says Rabbi
You could
Beto.
not look more Jewish than by wearing a baseball cap while you're walking around.
Now, it could be if they understood English, it could be a problem because it says on my cap, Legacy Kosher Tours. So I don't know if the disguise is complete.
Could be.
That's a problem. Yeah, that could be an issue. Okay. So, Legacy Coach Tours, of course, a mutual friend of ours, Miriam Schreiber from
Yes.
Chicago. She
Advertising.
just
She
had a
she.
great grandchild, great grandson last night. Her daughter,
Mazel
yeah,
tov. Mazel
Mazel Tov. So we went to Tunisia, and she's been talking about this for years. And I like have said, okay, big deal, Tunisia, another Africa. She was correct. Tunisia was one of the most mind-blowing experiences I've ever had.
Really? Really?
Specifically the island of Djerba, which is an island off the coast of Tunisia. Tunisia, for those who do not know, is North East Africa. It's like the most northern country in Africa. Borders Algeria, Libya, the Sahara Desert. A lot of it is there in Tunisia. Tunisia is a country with a rich, rich Jewish history. You mentioned Rabbeinu Hananel. We had Gaonim, Rav Hushiel ben Elchanan, Rabbeinu Hananel, first comprehensive commentary on the Talmud. Rabbeinu Hananel was in Kairouan, Tunisia.
Wait, you said the Rif's teaching was in Djerba
No,
or
in Kairouan.
and Kairouan though,
And
but
then
I
he
thought he
left
was in
for.
Fez. I thought that's
He's.
Al-Fasi is from
Al-Fazi
Fez.
means from Fez. It's
Right.
unclear if he was in Fez or if his family originally came from Fez. We're not
But that's
exactly
not where
sure.
he taught.
No, that's not where he. No, he
He
was
taught in
primarily
Tunisia.
Kairouan, yeah, and then
Okay.
Elisena in Spain. So
Okay.
Tunisia itself is a country where, as I've said, Jews have been living there, some say since the First Temple period. There is a legend of a certain one of the tribes, I forget which one it was, maybe.
The Navajo.
Too much Mel Brooks. One of the 12 tribes, apparently they say some of them went there in the First Temple era. Hard to confirm that. But definitely from Second Temple destruction, there were Jews in Tunisia. First of all, it was part of the Roman Empire. Some of the most beautifully and well-preserved Roman ruins are in Tunisia.
Is Carthage
Yeah,
somewhere near this?
Tunisia is Carthage.
Got it.
It's interesting. You look at the commentaries, the book of Yeshaya and others talk about Tarshish, the biblical
Yona.
Tarshish. Yes, so Rav Saadjigon translates Tarshish as Carthage. Carthage was Tunisia. That's where Hannibal, right? That whole empire, the Phoenicians,
Yeah, cool.
Tunisia. In the Book of Malachim, Tarshish, right? It says, Rashi says Africa, which actually Tunisia is North Africa. It's interesting that of the presents that were brought to Shlomo HaMelech from Tarshish, there was Shane, there was Shinhav, which is ivory from an elephant. There was Kofim monkeys, and there was peacocks.
Now, I thought that was an indication that they had gotten stuff from India. On
So,
our India trip,
yes, there are some who
there was
say,
mention about that
yes.
these would have likely come from India. You're saying there's a competing
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
notion that
Yeah.
they could have come from
I think the
Tunisia.
consensus seems to be that Tarshish, that Tunisia is Tarshish, which is Carthage, etc. So
Okay.
that is 100%, yes. And there were authors, Amoraim, contributors to the Talmud, who were from there. Reb Yitzchak Kartaginian in Brochus. Reb Yitzchak Kartaginian, Reb Yitzchak the Carthaginian.
Ah, interesting.
Rav Yehuda says from Tsur, Tyre to Carthage, they know of the Jews. Interesting, he should mention Tyre and Carthage because that was one of the primary trade routes of the Carthaginian Empire, was Tyre and Carthage. That was a central trade route. That's one of the reasons they created a trade routes and trade ports in Carthage, Tunisia. So Jews have been there for thousands of years, thousands of years. There were Berbers, who the Romans called them Berbers from the word barbarians, who were the indigenous tribes. And some of those Berbers were Jewish, actually. There were Jewish Berbers, people, some of them converted to Judaism. There were Jews of the Berbers there. There was the Islamic conquest in the 7th century, and Jews Kairouan became a major intellectual center. You have Rabbeinu Hananel, Rabbeinu Hushiel, you had Rabbeinu Nissim Gaon,
Really?
right? Yeah, Rabbeinu Nissim Gaon was in Kairouan, and it was, the Fatimid were fairly tolerant, and there was decline and ups and downs, obviously, depending on who was ruling. Almohads was pretty lousy, but Jews, continued a presence there. Now, there's an island called Djerba, which has a population of about 150,000 people. So it's a big island. You get there by ferry or by causeway. And Djerba has the oldest continuous Jewish community in the world outside of Israel.
There's some kind of pilgrimage, right?
Yes,
Like
on Lag BaOmer
a
to the Al Juba synagogue. There was a terrorist attack there. At that pilgrimage. So El Driba was quite something. The Jews of Djerba appear to have been there since, for sure, the Second Temple era. They are this,
Nice.
there's a thousand today, approximately 1,300 Jews in Djerba, all religious. There's a chief rabbi, Rabbi Bitan. There are synagogues. Active synagogues. There's a Beis Yaakov, a girls' school, K to
That's
12. There's boys' schools, kindergarten to 12. We went and visited the schools. The kids learn Chumash, Torah, using the tafsir of Rav Saadia Gaon, which Rav Saadia Gaon in the 8th, 10th century translated the Torah into Arabic. And the kids are in the cheder, little kids, elementary school, are translating the Torah into Arabic
unbelievable,
as they've been doing since
unbelievable.
the 10th century. On Friday afternoon, the rabbi goes out to the marketplace and blows the shofar to herald the arrival of Shabbat, tell people to close the stores and go home. There's a central bakery. All the kids who ride motorbikes, obviously, right? They come with trays of challah dough that their mothers made, and the whole community bakes their challah together in the communal oven.
Oh, that's
Then
cool.
they pick it up and bring it home. Then later on, just before Shabbat, they bring their chamin, their stew,
No
in
way.
ladle pots. They
No way.
put it in the oven and they pick it up after Shacharit on Shabbat.
Awesome.
There's a certain the They wear Judaism like it's just their skin. It's just so natural. The Torah is just a natural part of it. I've never seen anything like it. The sense of community that they have there. In the evenings in the summer, they in the marketplace, they're all go out there barbecuing together, making laffa, and everyone just, the restaurants, there's a number of restaurants there and snack stores, none of them have kashrut supervision because they're all people in the community. Everyone knows them, right? Everyone knows each other. They're all keep Shabbat, a lot of the students, some of the boys will be educated. The guy who was our logistics person, who's from there, David, wonderful guy, he studied in Gateshead Yeshiva for 4 years. His father wanted to send him there because he wanted him to learn English so he could get, the boys don't do secular studies. So they pick up English or French when they go abroad to study in Yeshiva. And there's 50 members of this community who are shochtim, who travel around the world doing shchita, and that's how they make money.
Got it.
The Gerber Shochtim are considered to be the top level. They will
Do
not
they know Nikkur?
compromise. What? Yeah.
Do they know how to do Nikkur? So you could get filet mignon from those guys.
Theoretically, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, we didn't have, but we ate well, but not. Yeah.
Not that well.
And they there's a lot of sofrim there who also produce Sefer Torah full mezuzahs and export them. A lot of them are in the gold trade, they gold jewelry, and there's quite a few mohalim, but they're a self-contained community. They have everything there. So some of them we had Rabbi Raka from Chicago
Yeah.
was with us, who
Really?
his family is from Tunisia.
Wait, he went with you?
Yes.
Oh, that's so cool.
His
That's very
family is
cool.
from Tunisia. We
Very
went
cool.
to a synagogue, the great synagogue of Tunis, not on Gerba. It's an Art Deco synagogue built in the 1930s. It's magnificent. His grandfather was the person who got the financing for the synagogue, and he'd never been to Tunisia before.
Oh my
And he
gosh, that is
spoke in the
so cool.
synagogue.
Is he
And
not an incredible Talmud Chacham?
wonderful. And
And
how?
he was in our grade.
Yeah.
He's our age. He's Yukos. He was in Yukos's
Yeah,
class
he
at
told me.
HTC.
He told me. And what's interesting is we went to an olive oil production facility, and the mashgiach there, the supervisor, the brother of David that we met, does supervision in Tunisia and Algeria and stuff, and for the CRC.
Really?
And he met, we said, this man is a dayan, he's a judge on the CRC. And here's the mashgiach who works in Tunisia for, it was like very cool, very cool. Just amazing. So that, and there are scholars who lived in Gerba. They had their own printing press. There's hundreds of books. We went to the library there, many old books. You open up the library, printed in Gerba.
Do they have unique minhagim?
Yes. They're almost all kahanim.
Seriously.
There's no Levim are not allowed to live there for more than a year.
Even
They
to this
believe
day.
to this day, yes, Levim, because of the Ezra fined the Levim for not leaving Babylon when they could under Ezra, and so the community still has no. They say Birchat Kohanim only on Shabbat, every Shabbat, as opposed to every day, which
Okay.
is type of interesting. In the El Driba synagogue, where they believe there's a stone, they say there's a stone from the Beit HaMikdash in that synagogue. They don't wear shoes when they daven there, because in the Beit HaMikdash, you didn't wear shoes.
Is that because they say they have that stone,
Yeah,
or
yeah,
because, yeah.
So it's a fascinating, fascinating community, and it's I think unique. I don't know of communities like that, where they literally have been keeping their traditions and the Torah, and they have certain poems they say in synagogue and shul. They have their own nusa, which is very similar to Eidot HaMizrach,
Yeah.
just amazing. Yeah, they wouldn't eat some of our food. We had a group of them, a family of the logistics guy and the mashgiach came to us to the hotel for Shabbat, that because they said that we. The Ashkenazim are lenient about certain things regarding cooking, bishul akum and stuff like that, and they wouldn't eat the meat shechted outside Gerba. So they're. But what's interesting is here are these guys
That's awesome. That's awesome.
who are, I would say, much much more religious than I, right? And they're walking around shorts, t-shirts, and we had a guy We went to one shul in a place called Galata, which is the it's a beach resort where a lot of Jews from Tunis and Gerba go there in the summer. So there's a shul which is on during the year. It's only Shabbat Sunday, they have minyan, but on summer every day. So there's a guy there. He's wearing t-shirt and jeans. He's leaning on the bima. He's talking about. He says, "Yeah, I'm the chazan of this synagogue, and I also, answer people's questions. I'm not really the rabbi, but I answer questions that I know. If it's something more complicated, I speak to the chief rabbi. I'm also a shochet, and also I'm a teacher in the day school here in Tunis." And he's just so casual that in the high school, the boys' high school, the boys we went in, they were studying. Their teacher is a masifta rebbe, who's got a blue check shirt and cords and sandals, no socks, and he's a Torah scholar. And they were learning Shelot u'Tshuvot. They spend about an hour or two every day with the high school boys learning responsa literature. He said it gives them a breadth of knowledge and a practical application. It's very interesting for them. So each one does any responsa they want by themselves, and then once a week we all do something from Ravadzi Yosef, Yabia Omer. How do they learn Gemara? He says, "This is how we've always learned Gemara. Hundreds of years they've done it this way. We learn the Gemara without any commentaries. Even the kids. I then ask them what they think the Gemara means, and asking questions, etc. Then after they've all expressed their understanding, we then look at Rashi. Then at Tosfot, they're big into Rashi, Tosfot, Maharsha."
They don't have a special feel for Rabbeinu Hananel or somebody like that.
I didn't detect that, but they
Or the
may.
riffs.
I don't know. So this is the community. There was Nazi occupation of Tunisia for 2 years during the Second World War, but there was forced labor, but they had very few fatalities. They have great Kabbalists. They had great Kabbalists there. They had some of the you may have heard Rav Chalfon Moshe HaKohen, chief rabbi of Gerba. He wrote Sho'el V'Nishal, Sho'els and Tshuvos. There's a Rav Yitzchak Chai Taib Lomait,
Is
street
he
in
the
Hartov.
high type street?
Yes, so he was a great tzaddik and Kabbalist, Rav Yitzchak Chai Taib. If you look at his grave, we went to his grave. It says Yitzchak Chai Taib Lomait. Did not die. So the story behind it is that when he died, the person who did the engraving on the tombstone wrote Yitzhak Chai Taib, mate, and then he wrote the date. He Yitzhak Chai Taib died on this date. He has a dream that night. Rabbi Yitzhak Chai Taib comes to him in the dream and he says, "Don't you know that righteous people, even in the world to come, still are alive? How dare you write that I died?" So the engraver wrote the word law, did not dead, in between Chai Taib and mate, right? So people now call him there Yitzhak Chai Taib lo mate, didn't die.
I think you told me that they redid it, but they kept
Unfortunately,
in.
the original tombstone was destroyed, but yeah. Also, by the way, Tunis was the place where the first in 1813, President James Madison appointed a Jew called Mordechai Manuel Noah as the American ambassador to the Kingdom of Tunis. He was recalled about 2 years later by M James Monroe, who said that his Jewish faith was an obstacle to his consular functions, which it was not. He had been one of the most effective ambassadors, but it was anti-Semitism, which is, we're used to, unfortunately. And that was in Tunis. So yeah, the actual place was something just mind-blowing. To meet a community, I don't think I don't know, just the simplicity of their that Judaism is life. There's no pretension. There is no they're not doing anything that for anyone else. It's not status. It's just a very natural Judaism that goes back thousands of years. It's an amazing thing to see. It was
Well,
inspiring.
very cool. Very cool.
Inspiring. There also, Tunis is also an interesting country because when it became independent in the 1950s, one of the first things that the president did was give equal rights to women. There's free education, state education, throughout going through to university. They don't have diplomatic relations with Israel, but Jews there are protected and have complete freedom of religion. And
Is it similar to Morocco? Would you say it's like, is it supposed to be
I
similar
think
to
it's more
Morocco?
secular than Morocco.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, more secular than Morocco. Like the official day of rest is Sunday. Keep in sync with the Western world. So they
Interesting.
export, one of the things they export, dates and olives and olive oil, dates and olive oil, big Tunisian exports. Yeah, pretty fascinating place. So, but the Djerba community was, I would go back, I don't think Legacy is going to do it again. Maybe, right? If
Yeah.
Miriam, if you're watching this, please do it again.
You try to time it for that pilgrimage for Lag
Lag
BaOmer.
BaOmer, yeah, that's Lag BaOmer. That's in the middle of semester. I'm not sure if I could do it then, but it's pretty impressive. So that was Croatia, Spain, and Tunisia.
So as we've discussed many times, first of all, this what's happening right now happens often when Mordechai's coming back. I often hear all about his trip, and then in keeping with the fact that we live parallel lives, so there's a natural assumption that while he's been doing that, I've been doing a parallel experience from my at my place. As you've heard, Mordechai's I during that time. My son Shauli came in from Israel, and he timed it to begin with the bar mitzvah of a grandson, my grandson's bar mitzvah,
Mazel tov.
which was in Chicago. Thank you, Ashi. And then that Thursday, so it was a wedding in Toronto of a nephew, Noam, who
Mazel
married
tov.
the daughter of Rabbi Karfunkel, who you said you know,
I know him well.
and they married him at the Beit, which you are familiar with from your years in Toronto. So we drove. I went to the rent a car. My regular car is a Mitsubishi Mirage. You know how when you buy a car, suddenly you look around and everybody has your car? That's a phenomena that people describe. Like you get a car, you hadn't really paid attention to it, but now that you have that particular car, you notice that a lot of people have your car. I got a Mitsubishi Mirage and never saw another person with that car. This is not a car, that people just go out of their way to get. So I decided I wanted a more substantial car because we're going to be driving a lot. We went
Yeah,
back
I
and
would
forth to St. Louis. We went
agree
to
with you 100%.
Toronto. So I go to the rental car place, and I really just needed a car then. So I go to the, and I've gone to this place in the past, and I go there, and he goes, right now, the only car I have is, and he points to a car, which is a Mitsubishi Mirage. Essentially, what I did was rent my same car to go all around, but it worked fine. It worked just fine. As I say, we had a moment. You know how you have this thing about hashkacha. We had this discussion about free will, and there's a similar discussion about hashkacha, like hashkacha pratis. Is divine providence, like how focused it is. We cross over into Canada. We're crossing from Michigan into Canada, like north of Detroit, and we're in Canada for maybe half an hour. Now, the area that we're in on this highway looks a lot like Iowa, or it's just farms, like fa lots of farms. It's lush, it's green, but lots and lots of farms, and we need to stop for gas, go to the bathroom, and to daven mincha. So we're getting ready to daven mincha. We're like off in the grass somewhere, sort of out of the way. And Shauli says something like, "Do you think there's a shul near here?" And I was like, "There aren't Look around. There aren't even Jews around here. So we're davening. And then as I step back from Shmona Esrei, I hear this noise behind. I hear somebody talking behind me. And I turn around and it's a guy. Not only is it a Jewish guy, not only is it a frum guy, it's a guy I know from Chicago. Not only to, I mean, he was even at Orson Mac when we were at Orson Mac. He was, and he happens to be, he was coming back from Niagara Falls, going to Detroit. And I'm telling you, they're even this place is so out of the way. And besides being out of the way, there were like four gas stations that he could have stopped at. You cannot see us from the road. The likelihood that you're going to see somebody that you know in a scenario like that, it stayed with me for days afterwards, like that experience.
Intense. That is intense.
Yes, it was. Anyways, and we went to Niagara Falls. We spent a couple hours in Niagara Falls and got to experience that. So I had a experience on this trip that was similar to an experience I once had when I was going to Israel, which was, and I'm sharing this with you only because of our deep friendship. I feel confident that I can share this with you without you breaking into hysterical laughter
I'm going to try.
when I talk about this. Just work on that. Just take a breath.
Okay, go ahead. Go ahead.
Okay, so anyways, so I have every once in a while I have an experience that most closely resembles things that people who've taken LSD describe. You just have a moment where you're just staring at something and it just suddenly becomes fascinating, even though it's extremely mundane. And the thing that I encountered, I don't know why, but when I was going to Israel and then on this trip as well, is location.
Okay.
When we speak about where we are, we tend to identify ourselves in the most specific of locations. But it doesn't have to, this is what was striking me, it doesn't have to be that way. In other words, for instance, if somebody asked me, where are you right now? My natural thing, I would say I'm in Northbrook, Illinois. Northbrook, Illinois. What time is it in Northbrook? I could tell them what time it is in Northbrook. But when I was on this road trip, like when you enter a state, when you go from state to state, like when I was coming back, I was by myself. I'm coming back from New York. I'm driving back from New York. So you're going like New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Indiana. When I entered Illinois, there was a part of me that felt like, all right, I'm basically home. You know, because you're in the state, you're in the home state. So, and there's times when I identify I'm from, you know, I'm from Illinois. When you're in Israel, a lot of times they treat you just as an American. They don't care where in America you're from. You're just an American, right? And that's how you, sometimes if you've been away from America for a long time, and you could be, you know, land at Kennedy, at JFK, and you feel like in some ways, you know, you're in at home. You're so you identify as being in America. Now, when I'm
100%.
here right now, I don't think of myself as being in America. I think of myself as New York. But why do I have to? It's a truth to say I'm in America. I could walk around with a consciousness that I'm in America. It doesn't have to. Why should it remain so local when I'm just thinking of where I am? And also, let's say I was an astronaut and you're in the space station, like those astronauts that got stuck up in the space station for like an extra many months where they had to stay up there. Now they just want to get back to Earth. You know, they're from Earth, you know, when they're up there. They
Great
they're
point.
they so I if I wanted to, I could walk around with the everyday consciousness that I'm on Earth, but I don't. I for some reason I and this you could extend this to our solar system, to our galaxy, to ultimately Olam Haza, you know, like you could try to, but but for some reason we choose to keep it local. And this one of the things this caused me to think about is Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, who when he says Libi Mamizrach, right? So he it seems to me that what he was conveying was that he tries to live with an everyday consciousness somehow, that he's somehow in Eretz Yisrael.
My heart is in the west, in the east, but I am in the ends of the west.
But what does that mean to say my heart is there? That means there's some aspect of his regular everyday consciousness
100%.
that he's associating with there, which shows that there is a possibility. We don't need to, but for some reason we choose to, can, you know, to think very, very locally. And I don't know. I don't know why that mattered so much,
Rather
but it was
interesting.
something.
Yeah, interesting. Interesting perspective. Okay. I gotta go.
All right, you do that.
There's a possibility that I'll be away next week. We'll talk about it. But folks, if you like this, then like and comment and share with friends and
If every
anything.
one of our viewers would take it upon themselves to get 1,000 other viewers, each one of you, 1,000 other
1,000.
viewers, then we'd have several thousand viewers.
Yeah, there you go. Right.
That's it.
Couldn't be too much of a challenge. Okay. Ice bucket. It's less challenging.
Yes, I agree.
Okay. All
All
right.
right.
It's
Be
been
well.
real.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing.